What I want to do this tonight on this whole subject, is faith really blind, as we look at this issue of is faith actually a delusion, is I'd like to approach it from a slightly different angle, as I said this morning. Now, in this millennium, the World Health Organization decided it would try to conduct the largest mental health survey in the history of planet Earth. So this survey took across many, many different countries, involved many, many different clinicians at very various different ways. The structure was put together to try to balance things out for race and, racial background, educational background, and all the usual things that you try to qualify in this. And it was to try to get a snapshot of the mental health of this planet. Now, what was interesting was that we discovered that in some of the most well-developed countries in the Western world, 26.4%, in the case of North America alone, of the people who responded to that survey were suffering from what was called mental distress right then and there. 26.4% suffering from mental distress now. Now, that's an amazing statistic. That means if you came here with three friends and they basically look okay, guess who's in trouble? Now, the survey further found that 25% had actually suffered from acute mental distress within the previous 12 months. Which means over a 12-month period alone, you're talking about half, 50%. Now, this raised some very, very interesting questions, because it was also discovered that in some cultures, the figures were way, way, way below that. And it began to raise the question, what on earth is it within our culture that means that more people seem to suffer from emotional distress and mental distress than we might be found in other cultures? What is it? Now, one of the factors that does seem to play a rather large role is your belief in God. Now, this doesn't mean, therefore, that if you believe in God, that somehow you are immune from this. That's not the case. But what they discovered was that as they began to look at some of the meta-surveys and the surveys of surveys, and then how these things broke down, is that it seemed that there were certainly three categories that we could usefully group people into. Group one were people who had what was called intrinsic religious faith. Intrinsic religious faith, that the idea of something that's within you, it was discovered that if you have an intrinsic religion and the sense that you understand that you have relationship with God, communion with God, intimacy with Him, if that is what is at the heart of it, you are less likely to suffer from any of these forms of mental distress by a very significant statistical margin than any other group. So in that sense, if the atheists are right in saying that believing in God is a delusion, it is a psychologically healthy one. Now the next group, although you drop by quite a significant margin in terms of mental health, is if you are an atheist, is the next most healthy group to be part of. The least healthy group, as a matter of fact, what may actually, in some cases, even be considered to be damaging, were people who had what was called extrinsic religious conviction. Extrinsic religious conviction stems from the idea that there is a God out there, and if we do certain things, perform various rituals, obey certain rules, then somehow God will smile on us and bless us and reward us for the good things that we have done for Him. That, it seems, may well actually be psychologically harmful. Now, the argument, therefore, goes like this. And although we haven't quantified it quite in these kinds of ways before, the argument, however, is an old one. And even Freud was able to notice that obviously it did seem that people with this kind of faith, this intimacy with God, or who they talked about it, did seem to be in this position. But the question was this, said Freud, this is simply the result of psychological need. Yes, it does maybe have psychological benefits at times, depending on exactly what it is. However, it is based on projection. And so, as he wrote, and you know, you can read all of this in The Future of an Illusion, he basically said, we live in a world of random, harsh forces. And this makes existence and life difficult. Therefore, we look for some kind of super father figure to step into this world to make everything right. And that's why we latch onto him. There is this need, there is this desire, and now what we have is something that actually latches onto that, and therefore God is a psychological projection that actually makes us feel more at home, more at peace, more rested in this world. And that actually, therefore, is able to explain why it is that we find so many people in different places believing in Him. Now, of course, the trouble is that this argument actually works both ways. So Professor Paul Witz, who wrote a book entitled The Faith of the Fatherless, he did a study where he actually looked at some of the world's most famous atheists, down through the centuries and their writings. So whether it was Voltaire or Sartre or Nietzsche or whatever, and looked at their psychological makeup. Now, interestingly, as he read through all of their autobiographies and categorized them, all of these people had absent, abusive, or weak fathers, without exception. So Professor Paul Witz, in his study as a clinician in this area, began to wonder whether atheism was a form of psychological denial. These people don't want a father figure because of the earthly father figure they have, therefore they're in denial when it comes to the idea of a heavenly father figure. Now, what does this tell us? It tells us that this argument gets us precisely nowhere. You can argue with complete integrity that God is a psychological projection. And you can argue with complete academic integrity that atheism is a form of psychological denial. It is not the psychology that decides this issue. If there is a God who actually exists, then denying him is a form of denial. If there isn't a God and he doesn't exist, then believing him is a form of projection. But it's not the psychology, the discipline itself, that actually decides it. It's the touchstone of truth and reality that decides that question. Is he there? That is the question that has to be raised and has to be asked. We can't dismiss him with psychology, nor can we establish him with it. But we can make conclusions if we have access to that prior information. Now, the reason why I want to start here is that, and if you're really interested in this, then let me just recommend a couple of books. There's a book by a guy called Professor Andrew Sims, former president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, called Is Faith a Delusion? So you can actually buy that. It's several hundred pages long. It looks impressive. It's a heavyweight book. It's written for his colleagues. Hey, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Or you can get on the internet, Google his name, and find the 10-page summary he posted online. Read that and pretend you read the book and let people think that you're more clever than you are. Is that there has been a huge amount of actual academic research in this field recently. This has actually become a boom area in some places. Why is it that we see this psychological benefit, and how can we possibly explain this? I don't have time to go on into all of it, apart from to say that truth must be the arbiter, ultimately, in this field. Now, having said that, there is a broader, maybe, context into which all of these debates speak, and it's that broader context that I want to try to deal with now. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the idea that actually life might be better if we didn't ask ourselves the kinds of difficult questions we're asking tonight. In other words, we live in a culture where some people believe there are no answers to these questions. Now, if there is no answer to this question, there's no point asking the question, because it's just annoying. You're asking a question that actually cannot be answered, or maybe isn't even capable of being answered. It's either going to make you feel depressed or frustrated. So you're better off not asking the question in the first place. Now, in this sense, the first popular philosopher in the Western tradition to espouse this philosophy was a guy called Baloo the Bear. Now, you may be familiar with his famous appearance, okay, especially in the Disney version, okay, of Jungle Book, where at one point Baloo the Bear sits spinning listlessly round in a pool, singing to Mowgli, and at one point says, "Don't be like that bee, buzzing around, looking for answers that cannot be found. But forget about it and enjoy the simple bare necessities of life." In other words, the solution to these problems is to literally stop thinking. Now, why? Why maybe is it that this seems to have such a hallmark? And I'd like to suggest to you that the fundamental answer is that if it is true that we are simply here by chance, that's just the way it is. We're just here. Then there is no point asking these questions, because they are fundamentally unanswerable. I don't know how familiar you are with a book that was written a while ago called The Diary of Antoine Roquentin. But in this book, it's a fictional diary of a guy called Antoine Roquentin. Now, Antoine one day is wrestling with these questions. He's trying to make sense of life. He's trying to make sense of the universe. And one day, he's sitting and he's looking at a chestnut tree. And he's thinking, well, what's the point of a chestnut tree? You know, they grow chestnuts, they look pretty, but you know, what's the purpose? What's the point? And he suddenly has an epiphany, an insight, a flash of inspiration. And written into the fictional diary is this line, without formulating anything clearly, I finally understood that I had found the key to existence. Okay, so here's this guy. He's sitting looking at a chestnut tree, trying to figure out why things are the way they are. And he has a flash of inspiration, and now he has the key to existence. Do you want to hear what this inspiration was? This is what he records. He says that the world of explanation and reason is not the world of existence. Now, what's he trying to say here? He's saying, look, there are two worlds. There's this world over here that only exists in your head. It's a world in which there is justice, meaning, truth, significance, purpose, where we look for meaning, where we try to interpret facts. And this world exists in our heads. Then there is the real world over here of trees, buildings, things that just are. And there is no meaning. There is no justice. There is no explanation. There is nothing. Things just are. And the problem is this, is that the world that exists in our head, a world where we want truth, we want meaning, we want explanation, we want these things, the world that exists only in our head is trying to force itself onto the world of existence, where things just are. And that's the problem. We are trying to force one thing, this imaginary world that only exists in our mind, onto the real world. And as Antoine Roquentin begins to reflect on this, he begins to feel sick, physically, emotionally, spiritually sick, sick to the pit of his stomach. When this novel was first translated out of French and published in English for the first time, it was published with a new one-word title that the translator, the publishers took from the translator. The title of the book was Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre, because that one word seemed to sum up everything you needed to know about the book. Maybe we just live in a world and that's just the way things are. There is no meaning. Stop looking for it. That's the problem. That's why you're suffering so much. Now, a very famous British existentialist, he put it slightly differently. Now, have you ever heard the phrase, in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king? Ever heard that? Now, most people think that is a metaphor about power. But there's more to it than that, much more. Here's the scenario. Imagine that you live in a country where everyone is blind. You only have one eye, and that one eye is partially sighted at best. But you can see enough to realize, A, everyone else is blind, and B, they think they can see. So what do you do? Do you go around telling the blind people, look, you think you can see, you think you have sight, but you don't, you're blind, and make them miserable? Or do you let them believe the fantasy? They're happy. Okay? They're content. They think they can see, but they can't. You just let them believe the lie because they're better off believing the lie. They're happier. What do you do? Okay, what is the responsible response? Do you burst the bubble or do you just let it stay? Which is better? Well, now you can see why a lot of philosophers don't feel very happy about anything. What they're basically arguing is that the philosophical insight we have, even though it is not as good as we would like it to be, is enough to let us know that you are blind. And the question is, do we tell you you're blind or not? What do we do with the faith community? Burst the bubble with science and philosophy? Or let them believe what they want to believe, as long as they don't hurt anyone, as long as they're happy? And so many now are captured and are caught up with this dilemma. And so what I would like to try to do is maybe deal with all of this. And let me suggest to you a couple of avenues in which I think we are beginning to conclude, or why we're beginning to conclude, that things just are. I can remember being at a wedding with a professor of history, and we'd never met before. You know what it was like? You know, we were both unimportant in this particular wedding, so we were stuck at the table, which is a long way away from all the others. You know, and you meet with a group of people normally you've never met before and probably will never see again. So we're just sitting and we're opposite each other and we're chatting away. And I just say to this guy, what do you do? He said, well, I'm a professor of history. I said, oh, really? You used to teach at Cambridge for a while and you just moved to university. I said, well, what kind of history do you teach? He said, well, I teach postmodern Spanish history. I said, wow, what's that? He said, well, history does not interpret itself, you know. History is whatever the historian wants it to be. History books are simply the historian imposing their meaning on the facts. The facts don't interpret themselves. The historian has to interpret the facts for you. When you read a history book, he said, you learn more about the historian than you actually do about what took place. History is whatever the historian wants it to be. I remember looking at him saying, that's an amazing idea. I said, this is an examined course at your university. And his face fell, his mouth opened. He said, well, it used to be, but students wrote whatever they wanted to in the exam. I said, well, that would appear to be strangely consistent with what you're teaching them. Is it possible to find authoritative, meaningful, interpretive frameworks by which we can understand where we are and where things are going? Because we currently live in a culture that says there are none. You know the story of the soldier who, or two soldiers, they were in training and to go into the forces, and they had their first extensive, you know, training. They were locked away for 3 months, not allowed out. And then eventually, you know, after 3 months, and those who passed, put into the next form of training, they're given a night out on the town. So these boys, they walk out, you know, several miles, they go into the town that's nearest by, they find a pub, they sit down, they start drinking. Now, by the time they come out, they've had too much to drink, and a thick fog has come down. So they start walking through the fog, trying to find their way back to the camp. And as they're walking back, they actually bump into the commander from that installation. Now, he's all buttoned up in his military gray overcoat, because it's cold. And because they're drunk and it's foggy, they don't quite recognize him. So one of the soldiers says to the other one, excuse me, sir, do you know where we are? At this point, the commander drew himself up to his full height, unbuttoned the first few buttons on his coat to reveal the military braiding across his chest, and said, do you have any idea who I am? And the first soldier turned to the second and said, uh-oh, now we're really in trouble. We don't know where we are. This guy doesn't know who he is. We find ourselves in a culturally disorientating position. We're not sure where we are or who we are. There's no interpretive framework. Now, what I find, particularly on the historical side, this is where I'm fascinated by the Christian idea of prophecy. Prophecies aren't things that simply tell you what will happen before they happen. They are things that claim to explain why things happen before they happen. The explanation and interpretation is given before the fact. So that when these things happen, you don't have to sit around saying, what does this chain of events mean? You simply have to recognize a chain of events, the interpretation of which has already been given. Have you ever looked into this? This church runs something called an Alpha Course. It's one of those opportunities to come and weigh some of these claims. Because for God to reveal himself is actually quite difficult. One of the ways he claims to meaningfully reveal himself so that we may know who it is who is talking to us is precisely through this way. Because only he has that future view. And his word is certainly authoritative. Have you ever looked into the claims that Christ came in fulfillment of prophecy? Or what these things actually say and what took place? They're fascinating to read and to study. And if it's the kind of thing that you have never looked into, then let me encourage you, because one great disastrous thing has taken place. Because of this idea that faith is somehow just simply what you can imagine, we now find ourselves caught. I don't know how many of you read any books by Umberto Eco. Any of you read Umberto Eco? He's an amazing writer. Absolutely brilliant. Umberto Eco, in one of his novels, he has a story called Bordolino. Now, it's very interesting if you read Bordolino and compare it to one of his earlier works, The Name of the Rose. You may have seen Sean Connery, seen that film? Obviously, you need to get out more. Now, in Bordolino, in Name of the Rose, if you're not familiar with that, that's a story about a monk who's trying to find the truth. It's like a detective novel. Now, Umberto Eco, who, according to one magazine a couple of years ago that had a poll on this thing, he was voted the most influential mind in Europe. And Umberto Eco in Bordolino, he tells a different story. Bordolino is a guy who's good at telling stories. And he starts to tell stories about the location of the Holy Grail, okay, the cup that Jesus drank on the night he was betrayed. And then Bordolino invents maps and documents. He himself invents them to sell to people, to buy, so he can get money, and they think they've now got a map showing where the Holy Grail is. Do you know how the novel ends? Bordolino sets off on a mission to find the Holy Grail using the map that he himself made up. It's utterly crazy. But if that is what you're understanding of what the nature of faith is, then you're not even going to be bothered to look at the evidence because there's no point. You already know it's not true. I can remember seeing Professor Richard Dawkins being interviewed when his book, The God Delusion, came out, and the BBC interviewer who was interviewing him just said, Professor Dawkins, some people are criticizing you because you refuse to engage with your critics, most notably Professor McGrath. Now, I was interested by the reference to Alistair McGrath because I work with him. So I was interested to see what he would say. And he basically said, look, what McGrath believes, he believes by faith. It's a faith. There is no evidence. He doesn't need any evidence for it. It's a faith. So he's basically saying, look, there's no point in me even looking at this or even trying to respond to this. There's nothing to respond to. But for that definition, there's nothing there. But that is not what either the Bible teaches or Christians believe. Jesus himself said, believe me because of the words I speak, or if you do not believe me, believe because of the evidence of the miracles themselves. Or you diligently study these scriptures, he says at one point to others, referring to prophecy. But these are the ones that speak about me. Jesus Christ invites evidence-based faith. Have you ever looked into it? Why not have a look and see? Why not come and do the Alpha course if you're not sure? This is not a brainwashing program. If you sign up to come and do the Alpha program, people will not come and stand outside your house at 6 o'clock at night with a guitar and start singing to you. And that's not how this works. And this is an opportunity for you to come along and find out. Have you ever looked into it? Maybe things don't just simply happen. Maybe there's a purpose and a reason even to why you're here this evening. However, it's not our study so much in how our literature has come, although I have to say literature has had a massive impact about how we think in this field, okay? Nor about our wrestles with history and about how we might find interpretive, meaningful frameworks to understand the world which is around us. By far and away, the largest contributor to the idea that we are simply here by chance is science. It's just random. We're just here simply by chance. There is no meaning. There is no purpose. A couple of years ago, I had the pleasure of spending a day with a man by the name of Anthony Flew. Now, Professor Flew is something of a legend, especially in one area in particular, because when Flew was at Oxford as a student, he debated a guy called C.S. Lewis, some of you may have heard about him, and was widely considered to have won that debate. As a matter of fact, his argument was considered to be so crushing against Lewis that it got published as a paper on theology and falsification and became the most widely reprinted philosophical article of the 20th century. Up until about 10 years ago, if you went to the atheist website, the secular or humanist website, you would find references to his books as being one of the basic books to read to develop a decent, what's called epistemology, theory of truth and knowledge, as an atheist or agnostic. His book was the recommended reading. And it remained recommended reading until a few years ago when he published a book that said, there is a God after all. It was called, There is a God. People were upset with him. People accused him of being senile, having lost his marbles. I remember spending the day with him, and he was shaking slightly. He said, you know, I have rheumatism, and I have to get people to write for me now. He says, typing I can't do. He says, but it doesn't affect the mind. Now, it was fascinating because Flew was actually a man who was always inherently interested in truth. And if you read his book, There is a God, and it's not very big. It's no thicker than my notebook here. Flew was one of the guys who helped champion the argument, if you give enough monkeys typewriters, eventually they'll produce the works of Shakespeare. Have you ever heard that one? Well, that's Flew. He was debating someone once and said, Flew, do you know someone's actually done this experiment? The British Academy, believe it or not, and as much as I hate to come out in favor of educational cuts since it affects our institution so strongly, there may be some argument for it when you hear this story, gave an academic grant to a group of students to put a typewriter in a cage with six monkeys and leave it there for a while and see what happened. After a month, apart from using it as a toilet, they produced six typed pages, but not one single word. Which is all the more amazing when you consider that the shortest word in the English language is A or I. However, to qualify as a word, it had to have a space either side of it. That means if you have a keyboard with 30 keys, most keyboards have more than 30 keys, but if you had a keyboard with 30 keys, the chance of getting a one-letter word is 1 in 27,000. Now, these experimenters, they began to think, wait a minute, forget about trying to produce the works of Shakespeare. What is the chance on this basis of randomly producing a Shakespearean sonnet? Now, Shakespearean sonnets are, by definition, 14 lines long. They took, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? There are 288 characters in the Shakespearean sonnet. What is the chance of randomly producing one Shakespearean sonnet using monkeys and typewriters? The answer is 1 times 10 to the power of 690. Now, let me try to quantify that for you. If you were to take all of the known mass in the universe and convert it into protons, neutrons, and electrons, according to our best estimate, there are 10 to the power of 80 particles in our universe of mass, as far as we can tell. You would need, the universe would need to be 10 to the power of 600 times bigger than it currently is to randomly produce a sonnet on this basis. Let's make it more interesting. Let's suppose you could take all of the mass in the universe, everything, all of it, stars, planets, I mean the whole lot, galaxies, and you could convert everything into microchips. Every microchip weighs a millionth of a gram, and every microchip, 1 million times a second, randomly produces combinations of 288 characters. And let's supposing that these computers have been running since time itself began. You would have produced 10 to the power of 90 random trials by now. The universe would have to be 10 to the power of 600 times older than we currently believe it is in order to just randomly produce one Shakespearean sonnet. But apparently, monkeys can do it every time. Now, Flew, when he came across this, and by the way, this is not an argument for God's existence. But when Flew came across this line of argument, he writes in this book, There Is a God, which is semi-biographical, he suddenly found himself with a huge problem. We are far more complicated than Shakespearean sonnets. It seems very difficult. Now, there has recently been a battle of the philosophical typewriters. I don't have time to go into it. Well, some of the argument is, look, some of these typewriters are fixed. So whenever you get a right letter in the right number, it just stays there. It doesn't change. But that seems to assume that the typewriter knows what the solution is, which raises the question of prior programming. So I'm not sure exactly how far that gets you, even though there have been attempts to somehow try to circumvent the problem. But even if we found a mechanism that explained the problem, it would still leave many other questions unanswered. Maybe we're not here by chance. Maybe we're here by design. Maybe we're meant to be here. It's difficult. These are very, very big questions. I'm fully aware of that. I'm recovering the ground probably far too quickly. There's a little while ago, I was speaking in South Africa with an academic called David Block, who I'd heard of because much of his research is published at the University of Oxford. And he's an astrologist. He studies cosmic pillars of dust. That's his speciality. And I never even knew, actually, to be honest, the first time I heard about this 10 years ago, I didn't even know there were such things as cosmic pillars of dust. Anyway, he came to the lecture theater, and he and I were to do lectures back to back. Now, he brought with him a projector to show slides with photographs taken from his astronomical telescopes. Now, I'm sure these days it could be digitized, but this projector actually had its own first-class seat to be flown from the observatory where he is into the auditorium. Okay? And each roll of film that went into his giant telescope to take the pictures cost £1,000, $1,000 a roll. And behind him was a giant screen, about 40 feet by 40 feet, so much bigger than this one here. And as he spoke, up on behind him came these images. First image, behind him, was of the universe, filled with little pricks of light, stars. He said, do you see the stars on this slide? He said, if you were to count the stars on this slide at the rate of 1 a second, it would take you 2,800 years. I remember thinking, wow. It's either very old, or he has a computer. Then he put up a picture of a cosmic pillar of dust. Now, I don't think I've ever seen anything quite so marvelous in my whole life. It is utterly astounding. And he walked up to the screen, and this big cosmic pillar of dust went almost from the floor to the ceiling, and there was a little bit breaking away. And he held out his hand like this. He said, you see the distance from here to here? This little wisp of dust breaking away from the main pillar. He said, that's the distance across our own galaxy. I remember thinking, wow. Then he put up another slide. The next slide looked very much like the first slide. All these pricks of light. He said, you see all the pricks of light on this slide? These are not stars. Each one of these is a galaxy. And then he put up this big blank square that filled the whole screen from top to bottom. Just a blank square. And then he pulled a pen. He said, if I were to ask you to draw the significance of your existence in relationship to the size of the universe, how would you draw it? Now, have you ever felt very small? I remember sitting there thinking, this could require years of counseling. What on earth is he doing this for? Now, having made this point, in which he said, if you were to take a compass, you know, that you draw circles with, if you were to take the metal bit of a compass and just come up, walk up to the screen and put a little prick in it, the tiniest prick, you would feel that you're overstating the significance of your existence in relationship to the universe, wouldn't you? And then all of a sudden, he did things which there's no hope of me possibly repeating. He started to, because he used to teach pure mathematics as well, he started to reel off from memory the mathematical equations for the formations of black holes. It's amazing how long it took just to recite those. And then started talking about weak and strong electromagnetic forces and nuclear forces and all other kinds of forces, most of which I didn't even know existed up until that point. And then he said, we are all carbon-based life forms. Now, I know that to be true because I've seen Star Trek. And it's true. We're all carbon-based. He says, for carbon to be able to exist in the universe, these forces I've been talking about have to be held in a certain point of tension, of equilibrium. He says, the universe is the size it needs to be in order to support the existence of carbon-based life forms. And then he quoted a Nobel Prize-winning physicist called Jastrow, who said, we shouldn't be surprised to observe a universe so large. We couldn't possibly exist in one that was any significantly smaller. What if this universe is designed so that carbon-based life forms like you and me can exist within it? What happens if it's not just a terrible waste of space? What if there's more to it than that? What about if there is purpose in all of this? Now, there is, however, one aspect in this that I think we wrestle with maybe even more than needs, and I haven't touched on it yet. We've talked on the fact that maybe that faith is not a delusion, it's not blind in the sense we just believe what we want to believe, psychology. That argument doesn't actually get us very far. The science that we've used has not actually proved one thing one way or another, by the way. It just seems to be compatible both with the possibility of design. And if you really want to bring that worldview to it, I guess, at times with atheism. But there's a different kind of absurdity in life, a different kind of struggle that we have that really does make us think that maybe faith is blind, that it is a delusion. It seems to make everything absurd. And it is a moral absurdity. It's the fact that we often find ourselves living in a world in which we often want to do things which are good and right, and we can't. Where we often find ourselves doing the things which we shouldn't do and not doing the things that we know we should do. And it is frustrating. In a book of the Bible called Romans, the Apostle Paul at one point says, I'm a wretched man. The good things I want to do, I don't do. The bad things I don't want to do, these I keep on doing. I find this law at work within me. Now, he says something very interesting. He says, in my inner being, I delight in God's law. I delight in it. I delight in the idea that there is a good, he's saying. I delight in the idea that there's right and wrong. I don't have a problem with that. And I earnestly want to do it. Here's the problem. I don't do it. What's more, the very things I say I will not do, these I keep on doing. Now that makes life absurd. It makes it morally absurd. It makes it impossible to live. And in that sense, we begin to wonder whether Christians are simply very good hypocrites. They close their eyes and they play the part. They pretend to be things which they're not. And this is now actually becoming a major cultural phenomenon. I don't know if any of you have ever watched that rather penetrating analysis on Western culture, Grey's Anatomy. See, some people watch it. I only watch it for research purposes. Now, what fascinated me in this series, and actually it's repeated in many others, is this. It's when it comes to the issue of relationships. In the previous season, this doctor comes up to this girl, and he basically says this: look, I have biochemical needs which involve sex. You have biochemical needs that involve sex. Let's not lie to each other about commitment, relationship, love, marriage, and all those other things. Those are just lies we tell each other to get what we want. I want this, you want this. There's a broom closet just around the corner. 5 minutes, see you there if that's what you want. Now, here's what I find interesting. This relationship is portrayed as being one of the most honest in the series. All the other relationships are based on lies. People lying to each other. I love you. You're the only one for me. I care for you. Of course I'm not with anyone else. That makes them fundamentally dishonest. But this relationship is honest. It's pure. It has integrity. There is no lying. There is no deceiving to each other. There is no misleading each other morally. We're simply doing what we should do. It is a way to escape this sense of absurdity. What do we do when we find that we simply cannot live one way and we're pretending to live another? Doesn't that make all of life ridiculous? And there may well be some of you this evening, and you're sitting here, and you may even regularly come to this church, and you're rapidly coming to that conclusion, that the whole thing is a pretense. You simply can't make yourself the good person that you feel that you should be. Is there a way out of this? I have a mentor. His name is Tom Tarrance. He works now with something called the C.S. Lewis Institute. You may want to Google his name after you hear this story. Please do not believe everything you read about him on the internet. He did not assassinate JFK or Martin Luther King, although there are plenty of website conspiracy theories out there that say that he did. What is true, however, is that he ran the most successful North American terrorist cell in their history. I don't have time to tell you the whole story. But he was responsible for hundreds of acts of shootings, killings, arson, bombing, and so on. Now, eventually, a guy called Edgar Hoover, now some of you will recognize that name, some of you were too young to know who that was, but you should know who he was anyway. Edgar Hoover, who was at that time the head of the CIA and the FBI, decided his number one priority was to eliminate Tom Tarrance. So he set up an operation to have him killed. One day, Tom parked his car outside a Jewish businessman's house at 2 o'clock in the morning, and started to walk up to the door holding a bomb. 26 sharpshooters had been appointed on roofs on the buildings around the one that he was going to try and blow up. And as he was halfway to the front door, they opened fire. He dropped the bomb, which didn't go off, and made it back into his car. This may suggest that these men needed further training. He started the engine, drove away. Or the engine probably, I don't know, was probably running. He had a female accomplice, a 21-year-old primary school teacher. She took a bullet in the neck, died in his lap 30 seconds later. And as they sped away, they had hid cars in the garages of all the buildings around the one that he was about to destroy. So as he drove away, they appeared as if from nowhere, chasing down the street, firing rounds of ammunition. If memory serves me correctly, 367 rounds of ammunition were fired. Eventually, his car came to a standstill. Now, that's a testimony to American engineering. When his car stopped, he grabbed the Uzi on the seats, between the seats, and as he came out of the car, he just sprayed the car behind him with bullets. The first policeman saw what was happening. He ducked behind the door. The second policeman was turning on his heel. He couldn't duck. He took a bullet straight in the chest and went into his heart. As soon as his clip emptied, the first guy stood up and shot Tom twice with a shotgun and hit him in the leg. But instead of coming to finish him off, as were his orders, because this was not an operation to capture, this was an operation to kill. And this is why this operation became so controversial. The CIA is not meant to kill American citizens on American soil, but there are lots of things they're not meant to do. And just in case you're listening, I admire and respect your work very much. But instead of coming to kill him, this policeman went to his partner, beat his chest, and actually got his heart beating again and saved his life. In that moment of confusion, Tom escaped. He hid in a bush. But they came with dogs, they came with torches, they found him. They turned off the torches, and they opened fire at almost point-blank range. When they turned the torches back on, he was still breathing. So one produced a pistol, held it to his head, and at that point an ambulance crew arrived. No one had called for them, they just heard the gunfire, and they came to see if they could help. Everyone was 100% sure he would die. It was just one big mess. Well, he didn't die. With enough surgery and everything else, he got better. He went to trial. There was a huge scandal. about the entire operation. Tom Tarrant was given 30 years in a maximum security prison. Now, after 6 months of being in prison, he decided he didn't like the accommodation the American government had given him, so he left. He rejoined his old unit, not knowing they'd been infiltrated by the American government. They betrayed his location. There was another big gunfight. He was recaptured, put back in prison, and given another 5 years, and also put in solitary confinement. Hoover recommended he should spend every single day in solitary confinement. He was allowed out once a week for 20 minutes. The rest of the time, he was in a cell 9 foot by 6 foot. Again, if you are young and you don't know how long 9 foot is, shame on you. Now, all he could do, therefore, was read. So he read Mein Kampf and he read various other books that he thought he would enjoy reading. And after a couple of years, he thought he'd like to have a Bible. He was a Southern Baptist. He should have one, right? So he started reading it. He got far as reading in the Gospel of Matthew, where it says, "What does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his very soul?" And for the first time in his life, Tom Tarrant realized that he was a sinner. He realized that what he'd been doing was wrong. He got down on his knees, repented of what he'd done, invited Christ to come in and change his life. The change was dramatic. Hoover heard about it. He heard about most things those days. He sent the agent who masterminded the operation to have him killed to go and interview Tom and send him a personal report as to what had gone on. That agent went on to write his own book. He says from the moment he entered the cell, he knew that he was looking at a different man. So profound was the change in Tom Tarrant's life, 2 months later, he himself became a Christian. While Tom was still in prison, he wrote a letter to the 26 men that had been appointed to kill him that day, asking if he could meet with them and apologizing for putting their lives in danger. 22 of them agreed, and 21 of them became Christians. After he'd been in prison for a few years, the Jewish business community, and remember, he was on his way to blow up a Jewish businessman with the bomb, were so startled by the change in his life, they started a campaign for his early release. And when he was released, he started to tour around North America talking about racial reconciliation and equality, about how wrong he had been, and of all the evil he had done. The Christian gospel is not just simply a message and a person who claims to be able to interpret events around us. He is also the one who can rewrite the human heart. To come into relationship with him is to be changed and transformed by him. We cannot change ourselves. It is a moral absurdity to pretend to be something that you are not. It is exhausting. But in him and through him and with him, you can be changed. And that is what is at the heart of what it means to become a Christian. Do you know that rewriting of your own heart? You cannot do it. You cannot pretend it. You cannot fake it. Well, actually, you can fake it, sadly. But you're not fooling yourself, and you're not, certainly not fooling God. But he can do it. Life doesn't have to be absurd. "What a wretched man I am," said Paul. "Who can save me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord." Do you know him? He is able and willing. He will change us if we turn to him. Faith is not blind. It's not a delusion. It does bring meaning. That doesn't make it true. But it should bring meaning if it is true. But most of all, he is the one who's able to bring transformation to our hearts now and ultimately to this very world as we look forward to everything that he will continue to do and everything that he will eventually usher in. You've been very, very kind. You've listened very, very well. I've spoken very, very long. And now I'll sit down and hand over to Steve. Thank you very much.